Welcome to episode one of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. I'll start out with a little bit about myself. I've been in the security industry for about 13 years now, and in the IT business for about 19. Security is something that interests me very, very deeply. I like to stay on top of things that are happening out in the industry, both from a personal curiosity standpoint, but also from the perspective of applying lessons to my day job. One thing I found very valuable is to look at what has happened to other organizations who have experienced relatively high visibility incidents. And fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your perspective, there's quite a lot to draw on. So there are a lot of podcasts out there that deal with security. Some of them are really good, some of them are really bad. I think you can figure out which are which. Some of my favorites, by the way, are ISD and Liquid Matrix, as well as the Internet Storm Center's Stormcast. I highly recommend people listen to those. But one thing I've noticed is they tend to be very focused on current news. We'll often mix in privacy-related conversations and a lot of offensive tactics, which I think are really cool, and I definitely like to listen to them. But I've noticed there seems to be something missing, and my intention is to make this podcast fill that void. And by that I mean a podcast that can take some recent incident, deconstruct it, and figure out what lessons can be learned. And we can often take those lessons back to our businesses and say, here is a real example of something that happened to a company because they had a particular exposure. And it makes it very real for management. I know that we all struggle with convincing our organizations that we have problems that need to be funded and addressed. Looking at it through this lens, I think will give us some additional perspective to give to our leadership teams to help make it real. So in that vein, I'm going to cover a couple of what I thought are pretty interesting recent examples of security incidents that have happened to companies or organizations and take a look at what went wrong, what we might suggest to do better, and what the lessons learned are. I'll also have a couple of different subjects I'll cover every now and then, such as what books I'm reading at the time, etc. So with that, let's jump into the first topic I want to cover, and that's DigiNotar. DigiNotar, for anybody who's not been paying attention, was a Dutch certificate authority that was compromised back in mid-2011. It was a pretty significant hack. The attackers generated about 531 fraudulent certificates. It's possible there are additional certificates that are unaccounted for. In the ensuing investigation, it was determined that about 600,000 Iranian citizens had their internet connections man-in-the-middled successfully because of this breach. So that's a fairly significant problem. As I understand it, the Iranian government used these certificates to man-in-the-middle communications with Gmail and a few other sites that possibly were being used by dissidents. So this is not a non-trivial thing. I will say it's a little interesting to me that somebody like the Iranian government would feel it necessary to compromise a certificate authority to generate legitimate certificates to do a man-in-the-middle attack like this. I would have thought that any government organization, even Iran, would have the capability of obtaining some kind of authoritative root certificate signing authority on their own. So what happened with DigiNotar? The net effect was that their back-end systems that actually generate the certificates were compromised by an attacker. And one of the really fortunate things for us is the security industry is that the Dutch government made public the forensic analysis that was done by a company called Fox IT. It's about 100 pages, a little over 100 pages long. And one of the most interesting forensic report reads I think I've ever had the misfortune of reading. I've got a link to that in the show notes, so I highly recommend anybody who's interested to take a read. So what happened? Well, as it turns out, DigiNotar had a fairly robustly designed network. They had things segmented into different zones. They followed what appears to be a good number of best practices, at least from an architectural standpoint. Where things appear to have broken down for them was with upkeep and just general hygiene. So we know that, for instance, there was a web server sitting on a DMZ, which is exposed to the internet, as it should be. This web server ran a number of different applications and had a database connection to a Microsoft SQL database server sitting in a different zone, as you might expect. But this web server was running an application called .NET Nuke. And that application had a vulnerability that nobody had bothered to patch. So our attacker took advantage of this vulnerability, got a foothold on the web server, obtained the credentials of the Microsoft SQL connection, started launching manual connections into the SQL server, was relatively creative, and managed to use that connection to take over the SQL server. It's a little muddy on how that actually took place, but the report theorizes the credentials actually had some privileges that it shouldn't have had. So from there, the attackers pivoted around inside the network and eventually were able to steal enough credentials and plant enough malware that they were able to compromise the backend systems. So I think it's important to highlight, as I mentioned before, they had good architectural controls, but poor hygiene. So they had firewalls in the right places and a fairly well-designed network. But what the report highlights was a fairly systemic bypassing of these firewalls. So basically poor rules or temporary rules that were needed for a period of time and never removed. And obviously a problem with keeping software packages up to date on publicly facing web servers. So what can we learn from this incident? One of the great things about this report is that the investigator provides a list of lessons learned. And so I'll just kind of walk through those right now. First is to separate system administrator duties from security and firewall administrator duties. And the reason there is hopefully fairly obvious that the two types of people have different objectives. So a systems administrator's job is about uptime, availability, convenience, speed of execution, and getting things deployed in a timely manner. So if you have your system administrators managing your firewalls, you're probably going to end up with firewall rules that you don't really need, you shouldn't have, or at least you shouldn't have for the long term. The next recommendation is to air gap vital systems as much as possible to make sure they are physically separated on a network from untrusted networks like the internet. This is a common theme in security discussions right now, primarily with respect to SCADA. It's very difficult to do. I'm a little frustrated when I hear this recommendation touted because it really negates the whole point of networking things. So we can, from our ivory tower, say, you all need to air gap those systems. But when you get down to it, that's very difficult and inconvenient to do. And I think a lot of businesses, as we see, often choose convenience and execution speed over security. So we end up in a position where things are very, very infrequently air gapped. And by the way, in a lot of cases, there isn't a good way to air gap things and have any kind of transaction volume scale. So that really says that we need to take a look at what risks arise from having systems like these that are not air gapped and figure out what can be done. And I think if you follow along in some of these additional lessons, that actually is addressed some. Their next recommendation was to update all software products on all systems with the latest patches as often as possible. You know, this is table stakes. It is really surprising that this has to be listed as a lesson learned, but I think, again, the reality is we all get busy. We have incomplete inventories. We have people coming and going in and out of the business, and things fall through the cracks. But as the saying goes in security, we as defensive people have to get this stuff right every time, and the attacker only has to get it right once. The next recommendation is to subscribe to relevant mailing lists or use dedicated patch management software to support the process. And really what that's basically saying is figure out when a patch is available. I'm going to take that farther and say, figure out when you have a problem. As a defensive person, I've become pretty frustrated with the view that vulnerability management is essentially a synonym for patch management, when in reality, they're not. If your vulnerability management system revolves around patch management, you have a serious problem. There's been quite a number of examples lately where a vulnerability, relatively serious vulnerability, has been discovered and not patched, or not patched quickly. So your vulnerability management process really needs to account for actual vulnerabilities and not just patches. So that might say that you might have to have some sort of intelligence gathering capability that identifies not just patches, but vulnerabilities in general. And that's a hard thing, by the way, because what do you do in the case where there's a vulnerability and no patch? Well, you have to do something in general. Certainly, you need to take a look at what that system's function is and determine what the appropriate mitigation is. So in the case of .NET Nuke, if there were a vulnerability that wasn't patched at the time, it could be as easily exploited as an old vulnerability that you hadn't patched. And that means you need to be aware of the vulnerability and take action. And that action might be to implement a mod security rule. It might be to tighten up permissions. It might be to monitor logs more closely. It could be a number of different things based on the situation. All right, the next item is to harden all systems. Do not rely on default settings. This is a fairly important one, but I think most people get this. There's a lot of resources available on the internet, but one thing I think this points out is the importance of change control and basic block and tackling in IT. So if you have a fairly robust activation process, so a process that defines the settings and steps and hardening processes before a system gets into production, that's really great, but it only works when it's applied. So if you have an environment that's not controlled and people can put systems up and people can install their own systems without going through the process, you don't have a process. The next recommendation is to make sure the that the most critical systems are only being used for critical processes that they're intended for, and that in turn limits the attack surface that an attacker has to work with. So this is a fairly common problem, particularly with smaller businesses, but I think it's also becoming more common with some of the virtualization trends that have been happening. So we will see organizations who have a relatively beefy server running their SQL database, their Exchange server, a file server, and a number of other processes. And that's great if you don't consider any of that important. But the reality is, every time you add a service like that, you're forced to open up new channels into that, and you're exposing all of the data to more attack vectors. The next item is to regularly have the security of your infrastructure and systems tested by pen testers. And equally important, do not always have the same pen testing team perform those tests. One thing I've observed is that a lot of organizations will say, look, I know we're really bad. There's really no sense in paying a bunch of money to a penetration tester to tell us that we've got a problem, because I can save a lot of money and say that we have a problem. I've been telling my management for a long time that we've got this list of problems. But the reality is, you probably don't fully understand the depth of the problems until you have a pen test done. And the other is just the consultant factor when it comes to management, that when you have an outside party coming in and saying, you've got this really significant problem, a lot of times management are more apt to take action. Basically, pen testers can make it more real. And the second half of that, again, is important, using different pen testing teams. And that really applies to audit teams and that sort of thing, where you don't want people to build a relationship and potentially results to be overlooked or swept under the rug or what have you. If you have new blood coming in, they have new perspectives, they might find things that the other teams hadn't found in the past. They might uncover things that were being obscured either intentionally or accidentally in previous tests. The next item is to monitor your systems and networks and make sure that anomalies trigger notifications to the appropriate employees. This is pretty easy to do in a smaller organization, but becomes really difficult in larger organizations that are dispersed. I think this is a fairly prominently featured action in the DigiNotar case, because there were a lot of signs that something was going on that no one really caught. So if in their case, if they had their key applications, which generate certificates, instrumented in such a way that they were alerted when certificates were generated, if they had some kind of a reconciliation process for serial numbers on certificates, they probably would have found much earlier that there was a problem. This doesn't need to be complicated. There are many different possibilities here. I'll give a great anecdotal personal example. So I run a web server, and I have different people. I've given email accounts on this server. I use a tool called the Config Server Firewall, and it monitors logs for failed login attempts. And it also monitors outbound email. A couple days ago, I was on my way to dinner, and I noticed that I got an email from my server telling me that one of these email accounts was sending a couple of hundred emails. Well, Config Server also tells you what IP address the connection's coming from, and I happen to know this person was not in Thailand and really had no business sending that many emails. So I was able to call that person pretty quickly, and sure enough, he had a virus on his computer that was being exploited by some attacker to steal all of his data. And one of those things they stole was his email ID and password. And they had taken that and started using it for spamming. So kind of like the old hunters would not let any part of an animal go to waste, the attackers aren't letting any part of a compromised PC go to waste. The next item was regarding OSCP responders. And basically, this really ties back to the previous one. In the case of a certificate authority, you have the ability to watch revocation data, serial numbers coming back from the internet based on the kinds of browsers people are using. And you have a fairly unique opportunity to match up the serial numbers to what you know you've generated. And if you see serial numbers that you don't recognize, that points to a significant problem. And by the way, that's one of the ways that we know the Iranian citizens were being man-in-the-middled. All right, next is to separate vital logging services from the systems that perform other vital functions. This is so key. It is hard to imagine that we have to call it out, but I see it done almost nowhere. So in the case of DigiNotar, most of their key servers were Windows-based, and the logs were being kept on the servers, of course. And the attacker, being the diligent attacker that he was, cleaned up the logs, or at least cleaned up most of the logs. And that really meant that the forensics people had very little to go on. What's particularly frustrating to me in the case of DigiNotar is they actually did have a central logging server for other parts of their infrastructure, just not for their servers. And I think one of the challenges there is a lot of people don't understand there are technologies you can use to consolidate all of your logs, including Windows servers, into one place. And once you do that, you can then apply some very interesting analysis to those for looking for problems proactively, both from a security standpoint and just a general IT health perspective. So their last recommendation was to ensure forensic readiness. This is somewhat obtuse, but a lot of things fall under this bucket, and that says make sure all of your systems use the same time base. So both your servers, your network devices, your firewalls, and your workstations should all be syncing to a common time base. And doing that will enable forensic reporting to be a lot more accurate and tie events together more accurately. The other thing it will do, just anecdotally, is particularly when you have all of your logs going into one place, you now have an accurate timeline, whereas if you don't do some kind of time synchronization across your environment, you've got logs coming in that have different dates and times. Now you can say, well, they occur in the logs in order that they came in, regardless of what their time was, and that's definitely true. However, it's a lot of extra work for an investigator. So the other important point on this item is to establish the right command and control. So to know who is going to be involved in responding to incidents, so that you're not figuring that out as the incident is unfolding. And also having a business continuity plan that says, hey, you might have a significant part of your environment down because of some kind of a forensic analysis that needs to happen. What are we going to do? And that might not just be servers, but it also might be people's workstations. I have seen incidents where a significant number of people in an organization have had to have their systems re-imaged because they had a very serious virus and they really couldn't do anything productive until they had their system re-imaged. If you don't have any plans for that, it is going to be fairly damaging to your business. So in addition to what Fox IT put together as lessons learned, I've got two more. And number one is to focus on good password usage or to use two-factor authentication. So if you read through the forensic report, you'll notice that there are a couple references to the attacker using Hashcat and a few other tools in the environment to brute force administrator passwords. So he had gotten a foothold on a server, gotten the password hashes, run them through a cracker. Because everybody uses weak passwords, that process was pretty speedy, and he was able to move about on his merry way. If we can get people to use stronger passwords, that kind of attack is going to be much, much more difficult. If you can deploy two-factor, it becomes nearly impossible for that particular kind of attack. My other recommendation is to limit the permissions of service accounts. So it's somewhat speculation in this case, but I've seen it over and over again where we have service accounts created to do a particular thing like a database connection, and that service account is given local admin authority or just generally permissions well beyond what it needs. And often that's done either through ignorance or because in the setup phases it had to be done that way, or any number of different reasons. So that's about all for that one. I'm very interested to hear if anybody else has any different takes on this particular incident. I know it's a little bit old, but the report has only recently been released, so leave a comment if you have one. So that's about all for DigiNotar. I'm running a little bit long, so I will cut it off there and pick up a couple of other ones I want to talk about next week. In particular, I want to talk about the laptop that NASA lost, the state of South Carolina's breach, and a few others. But before we go, I have a couple of fun things I want to share, and I'll try to do this every week. I often come across interesting tidbits to share. The first is a blog post by Stephen Chenette from IOActive. It's a fantastic article on the future of automated malware, and it really goes well beyond automated malware and gives a very thorough analysis of where we've been and where we're going to go, or where we're likely to go. The other thing I'll leave you with is a book that I'm currently reading called How to Measure Anything, Finding the Value of Intangibles in Business. It might not seem like a security book, but it is. Security is about risk management. And one thing I've really come to realize after reading this book is I didn't have a great handle on risk management. The author, again, while not directly related to security, has consulted on a number of security-related projects, and he discusses the relationship to security in the book. I definitely recommend it to everyone who is in the security field. So with that, I wish everyone a great week. The holidays are almost upon us. I hope you have a peaceful and enjoyable week. Goodbye.